mean, first of all, Napoleon's reputation. And you start off with a man who already has an established reputation across the 19th century and into our own time. A reputation as a great general, clearly. A reputation as a great political innovator, the man who created the concept of empire, who imposed that empire, who administered that empire across the continent of Europe. And I suppose also as a modernizer. I mean, if you look at the history of Italy or the history of Germany in the 19th century, they very often start the modern world or the modern period as they see it with the Napoleonic intrusion into their affairs. If you go to Milan, for instance, to the Museum of the Risorgimento, which is more or less a museum of Italy's national past, the first three rooms are concerned with the Napoleonic invasion of Italy and with the novelties, the new ideas, the new concepts, the new humanism which he brought with him. So I think we start off with a preconception of Napoleon as one of the great innovators and one of the great modernizers of the modern age. A secular figure, someone who didn't, as far as we know, have much belief in religion and who certainly hadn't much truck with the politics of the Catholic Church. A generally humanist vision, if you look at his writings, his juvenile scribblings, if you like, of the 1770s and mostly the 1780s, they are essentially in the mould of much of the humanist writing of the later Enlightenment. A man who served the French Revolution, who became one of its great generals, as we know, in Italy and then in Egypt, who then seized power in slightly ambiguous circumstances at Brumaire. That is to say, he was one of the conspirators behind the insurrection at Brumaire in 1799. He possibly wasn't the originator of the conspiracy. That possibly was Paul Barras. And the idea of the conspirators may indeed have been that the Directory, with its executive of five, should be swept aside and replaced by a tighter, more executive-focused regime with an executive of three. Well, there was an executive of three. They were called consuls. What Paul Barras and Sieyès had not perhaps counted on was that Napoleon, within 24 hours, would declare himself first consul, and that very quickly the role of the second and third consuls became a supportive one. So we see a number of images of Napoleon. The moderniser, the man who remains pretty loyal to some of the ideals of the revolution. He's no great truck with aristocracy, at least with traditional aristocracy, although he will create nobles if it serves his purpose. He has no great truck with those who had served Louis XVI. One of the things you notice with the empire, the men he promotes, some of them may be aristocrats, some of them may even come back from emigration, but pretty well none of them had served the monarchy or had shown their loyalty to the Bourbons in the past. He uses the men of the revolution. He uses the men of his generation who had already shown ability in administration and justice. And again, if you're looking for evidence of his modernizing tendencies, the idea of meritocracy, the idea of people as individuals. The ancien regime in France had always seen people as having those rights which pertained to the legal order, the legal estate that they belonged to. You didn't have rights because you were an individual person, you had rights because you were a member of the second estate or whatever it happens to be. Napoleon had no intention of going back to that. His was a world where individuals still had rights, and these rights were guaranteed by the state. Pretty well anywhere he went in Europe, the first thing he did was to impose, or the first thing his soldiers, his marshals, and his administrators did, was to impose the code. The Code Napoléon, Code Civil as it was originally called, which was a Napoleonic attempt, a very brave attempt in a sense, a very modern attempt, to restructure the law codes of France. Because think about it, what he inherited was, by most lawyers' standards, a bit of a mess. I mean, in the ancien regime, there had been something like 360 different law codes in different areas of the country. The revolution had imposed statute law. In other words, it had passed laws at the centre and it had imposed them. In the ancien regime, they had to go to local parliament to be registered and all the rest. Now there was one law for the country. There was also a constitution. So we had a constitutional law which governed statute law for all of France. But at the same time, there were still the remnants of the old regime. There were still the remnants of a system whereby, for instance, Roman law was the norm in the south and common law was the norm in the north. There was nothing logically structured to replace the old system. It was, as it were, one system piled on top of another system in a rather random way. To spend 4 years, his administrators, his judicial advisors, restructuring the law, creating a code that would provide a law code for the whole of France, was quite an achievement, and Napoleon knew it. So the first thing he did when he went into other countries, whether countries which already had strong legal traditions, like Holland, or countries where people had been serfs up to the moment of his arrival and had no rights at all, like fairly large parts of East and Central Europe, he imposed the code. So everyone who was a citizen of the empire had the same rights in law. The word citizen, of course, implies that you have rights. The word citizen had been used by the revolutionaries. You had been a subject before them. Napoleon clearly is a little bit uncomfortable with citizen. It perhaps implies that you have too many rights. Because his legal code actually is a very top-down thing. The state grants you rights as an individual. And it's a fairly paternalistic or patriarchal thing as well. The head of the household is the father figure who has control over his wife, who has control over his children. And of course, in a sense, the whole thing is pyramidic, with at the top of the empire the father figure of Bonaparte, of the emperor himself. The word that the Napoleonic administrators like to use is not sujet, for subject, is not even citoyen, for citizen. They tend to refer to people in official documents as les administrés, people who are administered, people whose rights, if you like, refer to their relationship with the centre and with the government. But you might say, looking at 19th century Europe, looking at increasing bureaucracies in the modern state, that actually this too was quite a modernising feature. I'm not trying to undermine Napoleon's achievements, not for a minute. I think when it comes to administration and justice, education as well, setting up lycée, the revolution had a very brave discourse. The revolution had talked about the importance of education, of primary schools in every parish. What the revolution didn't, of course, have was anyone actually to administer this, or anyone indeed to teach it. There were no teacher training colleges in the Ancien Régime. The only teachers were priests, in large measure. If you kicked out the church from education, as the revolution did, you weren't left with a lot. And the Jesuits and people who had provided education up to 1789 ceased to do so after 1792. So there was a bit of a void that had to be filled, and Napoleon does his best to fill it. He's not all that interested in primary schools. He's not that interested in everyone being literate. He is interested in creating a cadre of efficient servants of the state. So he goes quite logically for secondary education and to some extent for university education. He founds in 1800 something called the Université de France. And I would point out that even to this day, although there are universities in major French cities and a few others as well, and they are called things like the University of Clermont-Ferrand, they're all parts of one unitary system. When my colleagues in France retire, having been, shall we say, professor at Rouen, they become professor emérite des universités, of the whole university system, and not just of one institution. And the universities are linked to what we call the academies, which are the administrative units for education regionally, and the lycées, the secondary schools, which Napoleon also founded in this period, are part of that structure. So essentially, he provides secondary education, and to a degree, secular university education, for the professions, and indeed for state administrators. A very successful system, creating, I may say, traditions which France has never lost. The Grandes Écoles, again a revolutionary imperial creation, mostly in the 1790s, but a few of them in the 1800s as well, are there to provide the elite. They have competitions, they have concours for entry. You serve your 3 years, you study hard, and then you leave. And of course, for the historian, this is wonderful because we know who all those students are. We know the order of ability at the moment of entry, we know the order of ability in which they leave. And we also know that by the 1830s and 40s, those who leave the Polytechnique, those who leave the École Normale Supérieure and so on, with the top marks, get the choice of top jobs, and the ones they choose tend to be in the public administration rather than the private sector. So in a sense, this tradition of the modern state, Napoleon is very much responsible for embedding, not necessarily always to France's long-term advantage. Is he modern in his views? It depends what you mean. I think he is in many ways. He is when it comes to the Enlightenment, he is when it comes to the importance of the civil service, the importance of the state. He possibly has blind spots beyond Europe, because quite clearly his empire, the empire he envisages, is a European empire. If you look at the historic characters that he quotes and cites as his predecessors, they're people like Charlemagne. Charlemagne's empire in 800 had as its spine what was then called Lotharingia, which essentially goes from Holland through the Rhineland into northern Italy. The spine of Napoleon's empire was still Lotharingia in the 1800s. There was, of course, another model of empire by the time Napoleon was in power. It was the one that perfidious Albion had across the Channel, an empire that wasn't European, that was not based on the continent, but was based on the oceans and overseas colonies. And France, of course, in the 18th century, had an empire, I won't say to rival Britain's, but it was the closest thing to an 18th century empire in the Americas, in India, in the Mediterranean. Napoleon is not quite so clear about his ambition towards empire. I think he would like to have kept it. It's never a good thing for an emperor actually to be seen to lose possessions overseas. But of course, to have an empire, you had to have a navy. I feel slightly sorry for France here, I have to say. Britain was uniquely well positioned in the 18th century to do what it did well, because it could focus on the navy and it could focus on overseas colonies. It could, to some extent, ignore its European backyard. France couldn't do that. France was a continental power. It had to be able to defend itself against attacks from the east or from wherever they came. So anything it spent on the navy and on colonies had to be additional to its main expenditure on the army. And if you look at the treasury figures for France and for Britain, the commercial advance of England, of London in particular, was such that France was always fighting a losing battle. It was difficult to defend itself abroad in the colonies and to build up its power base in Europe. So Napoleon, in a sense, made a choice. He chose Europe. And as we know, the loss, particularly of Saint-Domingue, what became Haiti, and the fact that Haiti became, first with Toussaint Louverture, a state that was deeply admirative of Napoleon, that wanted to some extent to follow French institutions and Napoleon's lead. But then, of course, after 1802, a country that was deeply anti-French and deeply anti-colonial. So it becomes, in 1804, the first black republic, the first ex-colonial state, I'm excluding the United States for the moment, which had risen in rebellion against a European power and won. Slightly humiliating, especially as Napoleon had sent a navy and a bit of an army out there in 1802 to try to repress the rebellion, to try to regain control of Haiti for France, and significantly to try to reimpose the institution of slavery. And it's at that moment, I think, viewed from a global perspective, where you have to say that Napoleon's claims to be a great modernizer are perhaps slightly exaggerated. He wanted to restore the slave trade. He never quite did that. Slavery, remember, had been abolished in France in 1794. Technically, they did it ahead of us in 1807, but it was restored in Martinique and in Guadeloupe by Napoleon. And indeed, it's 1848 and the second abolition before slavery is finally abolished in France. To be quite fair and give the comparable figure, the abolition of slavery in the British Empire as opposed to the slave trade comes in 1835. So, what are Napoleon's qualities? Undoubtedly a great general, certainly in his younger days, and a political strategist of the first order. It's interesting, if you look at the courses that are taught at the French Military Academy for officer cadets, right through the Third Republic, right through to the eve of the First World War, Napoleon is cited as one of the great tacticians. Tacticians in the sense that he knew about wider strategy, also that he knew about battlefield tactics and what is known in the military as the operational arts. The revolution, I may say, gets almost forgotten. The Revolutionary Wars are not cited as exemplars of ways in which campaigns can be organized. What they are cited as is examples of civic virtue in action. The fact that you have civism, the fact that you have a citizen soldier, an army that consists, that is a reflection of society at large. And that also becomes one of the great military myths of France in the 19th century. But if you look at the great campaigns that are cited and that are taught at Saint-Cyr, again and again we come back to Napoleon. Napoleon at Marengo, Napoleon at Jena, Napoleon at Austerlitz. It kind of dies out around 1807 or 1808 for reasons you can imagine. That's why I said Napoleon was a great strategist, especially in his younger days. Because if you look at the tail end of the Napoleonic era militarily, it's not quite so glorious. I mean, the Spanish also from 1808 onwards is dragging the French army down. One or two fleeting victories in Germany in 1809. But after about 1810, there isn't a lot. 1811, they're preparing for the Moscow campaign, which was, you might say, an unmitigated disaster. In 1813, magically perhaps, he has somehow or other lost 600,000 men in Russia, and he creates another army, and he drags it off to Central Europe and loses again at Leipzig. By 1814, he's fighting the Campagne de France. He's fighting for the first time since 1793 on French territory. All France's wars had been fought abroad, had been fought on other people's land, and usually on other people's fodder, foodstuffs, and resources as well. And now suddenly, France had to defend its own territory. They did it very bravely. Ironically, they did it by the very means that Napoleon had been denouncing for so long. Remember what he said in Spain in 1808 and 1809, that there's a right way to fight, and that is the honorable way in which the French army fights, and there is a wrong way, and that's how guerrillas fight, you know, throwing stones from behind bushes, capturing those who drag on behind, sometimes torturing them, and then sort of filtering back into the villages from which they came. That's the sneaky way, that's the cowardly way. By 1814, the French in the east, in Lorraine, in Alsace, in the Ardennes, are being encouraged to do exactly the same, to rise as a man against the invader, be he German or Russian or whatever, and to save their communities for the future. So essentially, I think Napoleon, yes, was a great general, but he wasn't an infallible one. Even the Egyptian campaign early on, you can argue it was an enormous public relations victory in Paris, but it wasn't such a great military victory. He left his army behind. But
it's just the door between the other main room.
Right.
Can I try to raise my voice and perhaps speak a little bit more slowly? What I'm saying, I think, is that, yes, Napoleon had real achievements. But one of the problems for the biographer coming to this is that Napoleon himself, throughout his reign, goes to greater extremes, great efforts, to tell his own story, to make up his legend, if you like. I mean, the most dramatic version of this happens on St. Helena, where the British exile him in 1815 after Waterloo, wisely or unwisely. It's a very boring place to be. He's got nothing to do there, but he does have a number of loyal advisors around him, and he dictates his version of events, which tends to be the way in which he wants history to remember him. But even if you go back to his early days, as a general of the revolution in Italy, for instance, when he doesn't have the political power he will have as emperor, he is already preparing his legacy. He employs journalists. Modern armies do that, but this was quite advanced for the time. Journalists to write newspapers. Some of them directed at the soldiers to give them encouragement. After all, soldiers in a campaign know very little about what's happening on other fronts. They're dependent on information that they're given, and Napoleon made sure that they were given a very upbeat version of what was happening. But also, and more importantly, for an audience back in Paris. Because when he was in northern Italy, when he was in Egypt, when he was in Syria, he was immensely conscious of the fact that he wasn't in Paris. He wasn't in the place where decisions are made and people get noticed. If you go back to the revolution for a moment, very interestingly, most of the Jacobin deputies went on mission. They went away from Paris for 9 months, 12 months at a time in the provinces. Robespierre didn't. He stayed in Paris the whole time. Wise man. It's a way of keeping control over your image and over your legacy. Napoleon knew this. And he didn't write the rubbish himself. He got key figures of his day. Revolutionary journalists, like Proudhon, for instance, who were out of fashion under the Directory, but who had been great journalists of their moment back in the early 1790s, he got them to write copy for the main papers in Paris. And it was cleverly done, too. It wasn't paeans of praise to the emperor all the time. Much of it was praising his men, was praising his soldiers. But then you suddenly notice the change in tone. Just before Brumaire, you suddenly get a whole series of articles written about the glory of their young general. From Egypt, you get a great deal about the glory of the Egyptian empire, how one empire is now being recovered and discovered for Europe by another, by the great empire which has replaced the Egyptians, which has replaced the Greeks, which has replaced the Romans in European history. An enormous amount of propaganda, in other words, is going on. He goes to the opera in Paris. It seems a silly thing to say, but he chooses the programs to some degree. Operas which praise great kings, great heroes, great military leaders. He sets the themes for the artistic competitions at the Salon of Paris every 2 years, which is one reason why battlefield scenes in particular become so prominent during the Napoleonic years. But there are also images, as we'll see in a moment, of himself as the caring leader. I was at an exhibition not very long ago on Alexander the Great. This may tell you very little. But one of the things about Alexander the Great, when he went into the Caucasus, when he went into southern Russia, was that he viewed himself as being a civilizer, not just a soldier who won battles, but as someone who went into the lands of the barbarians and brought in culture and civilization. Napoleon courts Alexander the Great a great deal, and it's clear that Napoleon sees himself also as a great civilizer, as something more, a man with more qualities, with more weight, with more significance than a mere soldier. So you get this combination of military might on the one hand, the great lawgiver, the great civilizer, on the other, and these images come across again and again in Napoleonic propaganda. So by the use of artists, by the use of sculptors to some extent, Napoleon creates a permanent legacy for himself. And what I want to do for the second part of the talk this morning is to talk a little bit about that legacy, about how the 19th century saw him. Because the creation of the Napoleonic legend is not purely Napoleon's doing, it's what happens after 1815, after the Bourbons have been restored. So if I could just talk for a few minutes verbally, as it were, and then turn to a few pictures to illustrate what it is I'm saying. If you look at the 19th century, well, for the first period, the period of the Restoration is a bit of a blank. It's a period when the kings who have been restored have every interest in rooting out all possible memories of the Napoleonic Empire. Anyone who conspires or who is deemed to be an apologist for Napoleon tends to be spied on by the secret police and denounced. I'm thinking, for instance, in the 1820s of people like the four sergeants of La Rochelle, who may or may not have had a Bonapartist conspiracy, but they certainly met in the upper room above a pub in Paris, were spied on, were denounced for conspiracy, and were executed. That's in 1822. It's not a good period to be a Bonapartist. And I should also point out that the sort of personal circumstances of so many of the soldiers of Napoleon were dire in this period. And obviously the war was over. Obviously you had to decommission the very large wartime armies. You put the officers on demi-solde. You sent the men back to their homes. So there are a lot of people who have come back from the war. And it had been a pretty ghastly war. It wouldn't have been awfully nice going to Moscow with Napoleon in 1812. But somehow when you look back on it from 1816 or 17 or 18, from a position of unemployment and a position of not having any particular status in your society, they do begin to look like the most romantic and the best years of your life. And this, of course, is a romantic age. So never forget the impact that Napoleon has on the romantic imagination. Authors like Victor Hugo, Waterloo, Morne Plaine, the sad mists of a morning coming over the Waterloo battlefield, one of the great poems of the 19th century. But, you know, even Walter Scott writes about Napoleon. Balzac writes about him. Vanity Fair is essentially about Waterloo. I mean, there's a whole literature of the 19th century on both sides of the Channel which looks back at these wars, and probably in Britain as well as in France, one would have to say, Napoleon is the figure who is charismatic for the 19th century. It certainly isn't Wellington. So romantic novels, romantic art, as we will see in a few minutes, reminders of empire in public ceremonial. The Bourbons wouldn't do it. The Republic was always a little bit uncertain what to do with the Bonapartist legend. The Republic, after all, is fighting for votes. It's fighting for votes from the same kind of people who might also be imperial sympathizers. So there's no necessary reason why Republicans should be well disposed towards the empire. On the other hand, the myth of the revolutionary army, the myth of the Bonapartist army, the two very easily become blurred in the 20th century, in the 19th century, and indeed into the early 20th. And it becomes a sort of single vision of a French army, the people in arms, rising from the population and driving all before them. A romantic image which gets rather shattered in the Franco-Prussian War in 1871, but that doesn't mean that the image doesn't remain and doesn't, in fact, get resurrected in the 1880s and 1890s. But with the Second Empire, with Napoleon III in power, of course people are trying to resurrect the empire, the memories of the First War. Of course they are. 1857, Napoleon III issues the Médaille de Saint-Hélène, the St. Helena Medal, to every man who had served his great uncle in the war. 1857 is 42 years after Waterloo. I'm slightly reminded of this, actually. The British seem finally to have decided to give medals to people in the Arctic Fleet and so on. You've probably noticed on the news, waiting so long that hardly anyone is left. 42 years may seem a long time, but the prefects in every department in France were told to find all the survivors of the Napoleonic Wars still living in their department. And they issued more than 400,000 medals. There were 400,000 people, half a century later, let us say, in French life, many of them now as old men, revered in their villages and so on, who had lived, who had memories of the Napoleonic Wars. I could add, by the way, with all the pride of an adoptive citizen of the Ardèche, which is the department I occasionally go to, that the last Frenchman, the last survivor of them all, was one of us. He died in Aubenas in 1894. Although I believe the last surviving soldier of the Napoleonic armies, and that tells you a lot as well, because it wasn't a French army, it was an international army, he was Polish, and he died in the 20th century, in 1901. In other words, this is a legacy which is going to last. And the spoken message, there are no veterans associations, there are no meeting places where these things can happen, but in bars and in pubs and the rest, the message is explained. Okay, so communicative memory, art memory, and popular images as well as high art. I mean, I've been talking about painters, but you can talk also about lithographers. and these popular images called images d'Epinal, brightly coloured, cheap prints, if you like, started in the 18th century very largely with pictures of saints, but saints gave way little by little in the 1830s and 1840s to pictures of Napoleonic events, Napoleonic soldiers, Napoleonic uniforms, which became immensely important in public memory. Oh, and also in public ceremonial. Louis-Philippe was a king, of course. His coronation was in 1831. I can simply point out to you that at his coronation ceremony, he was surrounded by four marshals. I mean, the bid by the state, by the government, to somehow acquire reputation and legitimacy by associating itself with the Napoleonic legend is very strong. And need I say more, the Napoleonic tradition, the Bonapartist tradition, which is essentially a popular tradition, is a tradition of popular politics, but popular politics untrammeled by the things that get in the way of the relationship between the strong leader and his supporters. And things like parties, elections, much too important. But the idea that you can have a strong savior who will come and save France in moments of desperate misery remains. And I think, to some extent, when the Boulanger in the 1880s, Philippe Pétain after the First World War, a soldier's soldier in many ways, who could say that he looked after his men in the First World War, and becomes, of course, the leader of the Etat Français in 1940. And if I may put it in the same sentence as Philippe Pétain, who wouldn't like it, Charles de Gaulle, who is to some extent in the same tradition, a strong military leader who will save his people against their natural enemies. Anyway, you've heard far too much of me. Do you mind if I just show you a few pictures to lighten the film a little bit? There's nothing very realistic about the way in which Napoleon gets himself represented. And this is one of David's sketches from the 1790s, a young general, undeniably handsome, alert, the sort of person you want to have defending your shores, I'm sure. And many of the images are, well, to put it mildly, idealized. This again is David. Theoretically, at least, Napoleon, as he is about to cross the Alps into Italy to save all these Lombard kingdoms from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I mean, you know and I know that to get across the Alps, you actually use a donkey or a mule. It is the only effective way to get across the mountain paths, but it doesn't quite make the same impression or leave the same image for history. And there we go again. I mean, the young Napoleon, a military figure, a certain swagger, undeniably handsome, even, I have to say, in British cartoons of the period, which are universally antagonistic to Napoleon, he comes across as being slim, handsome, undoubtedly scheming and untrustworthy, but these are different sorts of qualities. A lot of the painting is military, and I won't give you more than a few examples of it. This refers to the war in Italy, and it refers to a moment when Napoleon gives succor to or gives comfort to a dying general on the battlefield. I mean, the point about it is that it's not purely about military glory, it is about military glory and sympathy and empathy and a man of genuine feeling for others. So there is a humanity about it which is intended to impress. From Italy to Egypt. Egypt was, of course, a glorious opportunity for photo shots, as you can imagine. Pyramids in some of them, palm trees in others, Mamelukes all over the place. The idea of Orientalism is already popular at the end of the 18th century in France. There's a mood which wants to appreciate these faraway places and these empires. And here is a Frenchman among the camels, savoring his victory at the Battle of the Pyramids. Again, two or three of these pictures, all the same, the shadow, the light, the mystery of the Orient, as Napoleon, again, rather incredibly, on a white horse, comes into the alleyway in order to forgive the citizens of Cairo who have rebelled against him. This one has the most famous painting from the Egyptian campaign, the plague hospital at Jaffa, where Napoleon, again, you may think a little bit implausibly, is there in the middle giving succor to, indeed touching, the plague victims, the lepers and the others, at great, doubtless, personal risk to himself. How often this actually happened, or indeed whether it actually happened, is not the point. The image is a wonderful image to show, at the same time, compassion and glory in a single stretch. Most of the pictures from this period, most of the battle scenes, are fairly uncomplicated. They are a little bit like the one earlier. They show Napoleon in the middle, they show him surrounded by his guard, they show the French being victorious. What they don't show, on the whole, is the cost of war. And I put out this one, one of the famous pictures of the Battle of Eylau, which was a French victory nominally, but a great, great human cost. But the point about this one, I don't think Napoleon necessarily approved of this, is the great piles of corpses and human misery in the foreground. I mean, the painter is making the point, yes, it was a victory, yes, there was glory, but it was hard won, and whether it was worth it or not is questionable. Enough of war for the moment. Let's turn to the great democrat and empire. This is Napoleon's coronation. Napoleon's coronation, as captured by David, inside Notre Dame in Paris. The doors of Notre Dame weren't quite wide enough for the cortege to get in effortlessly, so they were widened for the occasion, with bits of cardboard wall added on and so on. All the crowned heads of Europe were invited. They all had their placings. As you can see, it is a moment of great state ceremonial, with the Pope sitting demurely by Napoleon's side. And famously, he wasn't allowed actually to put the crown on Napoleon's head. That might just have created the image that the state was in some way subsidiary to the church. That, of course, is what had happened to Charlemagne. Charlemagne was the last French leader, if I can call him that, Frankish leader, to have been crowned by the papacy in 800. Charlemagne, of course, had made the long and hazardous journey to Rome to see the Pope. On this occasion, the Pope was summoned to Paris to see Napoleon. The change is fairly clear, and they even created a sort of crown in the model of the crown of Charlemagne to place on Napoleon's head. And the imagery, I think, is not in doubt. I'll pass over that without comment. It's one of a number of images of the emperor. He obviously thought it was astoundingly full of the kind of dignity that the office demands. Perhaps the 21st century has other ideas. The point I'd make about Napoleon as emperor is that suddenly he wants to be on a level with the other crowned heads of Europe. As we know, he gets rid of Josephine fairly quickly hereafter, probably on the grounds that she couldn't provide him with an heir, which, if you are an emperor, is rather important. And he looks around for a new queen, a new empress, and he finds that there's a choice, really, between the daughter of Alexander I of Russia, who gets rejected, and the daughter of the Austrian emperor, who gets accepted. The Russians are really quite annoyed by that, at least by the insult that it implies, and Marie-Louise, in 1809, is betrothed to Napoleon. I should say, at the wedding ceremony, they use exactly the same service that Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, word for word, had used back in the 1770s. And it is, of course, a link between the same thrones, the throne of France and the throne of Austria. Anyway, a great deal of public building is planned in this period, for Paris in particular. Great palaces of a classical model. That one I chose because, well, there's a nice little Arc de Triomphe plan there as well, which was actually built. The building itself was planned in 1812 to house the archives of the French Empire and becomes the basis of a building which I really quite like over the years, the Archives Nationales, but it is much more grandiose than the actual model that was adopted. 1812... A slightly more honest, slightly podgier Napoleon, perhaps, in his office in Paris. Full of details, sort of elements of Egypt, reminding you of conquests on his desk. The Code, of course, the Code Napoleon, the most important of his documents for the rest of the empire, lying on his desk as well. A sword, which indicates perhaps the combination of plume and fer. And please note the clock at 4:15 in the morning as your deeply committed emperor continues to work for you through the night. I mean, the propaganda is always there. And it is a glorious picture of the way he wanted to be remembered as a man of peace and a man of law, rather than purely as a man of military action. A couple of British cartoons. I'm sorry about the quality of these ones. I took them off the internet and I regret it. That famous one, basically, of Pitt and Napoleon carving up the plum pudding of the world. That, during the Spanish War, a British representation of what happens to Napoleon once he gets into the Spanish bullring. And I'm now going to move on to, as it were, life after death, if I can call it that to some extent. This is not a British cartoon. This is the first of a number of the Images d'Épinal, these rather simple lithographs that the French produced to very good effect in the 19th century. By the time Napoleon is exiled to St. Helena, I think here and in Britain to some degree, he becomes less of a threat, obviously, and he becomes more of a tragic figure. There's just an element, it seems to me, of tragedy. But the man who once ruled an empire is now left ruling a rock in the South Atlantic with some seagulls for company. This is a French version, and a French version that comes from the 1830s, sort of looking back on him in his pensive forced retirement on St. Helena, with his flag marked Empire Français and so on, and his eagle rather than a seagull for company. But it's a sort of image that began to replace the saints on the mantled borders of French peasants in the 1830s. I mentioned a few moments ago Louis-Philippe having Napoleonic marshals at his coronation. The 1830s under Louis-Philippe, also the period when a whole series of commitments were made. They erected on the Place des Pyramides in Paris the column, which was brought back from Egypt, so it was an Egyptian column, a reminder of his Egyptian campaign, with, you may think slightly preposterously, a statue of Liberty Capital Rale stuck on the top. I mean, if you go there today, the column is still there, the statue is not. But then France has come through a number of regimes since. One of the things, in spite of all the art that you will notice, is that Napoleon was not terribly keen on statues of himself. He certainly didn't like classical nude statues of himself, like the one that ended up in Aspley House, and he was well aware, from his experience of the 1790s, of what happens to statues in times of political revolution. Kings get toppled, they get their heads chopped off, they get the horses overturned in the middle of the squares of Paris, and he didn't really want that to happen to him. Sorry, but the Commune in 1871 was less forgiving, and the little statue was last heard of in the mud at the bottom of the Seine near the Pont d'Anières in the outskirts of Paris. Nevertheless, get back to the 1830s and 1840s, to the kind of, to us perhaps slightly ridiculous, iconography that Napoleon creates after his death, or is created for him after his death. Gloire nationale being identified with the Battle of Austerlitz here, Egyptian columns, Italy, Egypte, and so on, gloire et patrie, and a slightly savage picture of Napoleon himself. Now, I don't want to lecture you on the slightly slippery quality of saints in the Catholic Church. And many of them, you can create them fairly easily if you really want to. Some of them get knocked off every now and then as, well, not having been quite the good man they were supposed to be. Or in the case of Brittany, sometimes, in the parish of Brittany where they had lots and lots of saints, sometimes because they'd never existed, or in one wonderful case, because it turned out to be a wild animal. You know, you get rid of saints when they become cumbersome. In 1806, a new saint appeared on the French Catholic calendar, Saint Napoleon. He was a military saint, of course, rather like St. George in England. And he had a day, a saint's day, like every other saint, which conveniently was the 15th of August. I recommend this to people because it is Assumption, so Catholics would be in the habit of going to church anyway. This was probably quite important. It was also his birthday, so it was convenient, and it was the anniversary of the Battle of Marengo. So for all sorts of reasons, the 15th of August seemed a good idea. Well, some people go. I think it does depend regionally. A lot of people didn't. In the 1850s, of course, the legend of St. Napoleon is once again fairly prominent. The only point I would make to you is that St. Napoleon is an eminently Plasticine figure. Here he is essentially a Roman soldier of antique Rome. There is a splendid little prayer at the bottom. Faites à Dieu puissant que par les prières et l'exemple de votre bienheureux martyr, Napoléon. So he is not just a saint, but he is also a Catholic martyr. Dont nous célébrons le triomphe, nous soyons affermis dans l'amour de votre saint nom. So it is basically a sort of prayer to a Catholic saint. But don't worry, if you don't like the Roman version, there's a pretty good medieval version as well. it is a Plasticine figure. You can dress him up more or less as you like. Anything like Napoleon, but there he is, the Patron des Guerriers, 1842. I'm not showing this because it is a great painting. I'm showing it because it is fairly typical of a certain genre of painting, known as the apotheosis of Bonaparte. But here you have him being received into the clouds and past the gate of St. Peter. He has risen from the dead. Never forget that during the period between 1821, when he does actually die, and 1840, when the body, usually referred to as les cendres, but it is actually a corpse rather than ashes, is brought back to Paris. There's a great call among the faithful in Paris for Napoleon to come back. There's even a belief that he is not dead and that he will return. And there's a poem by Béranger that says as much. He will rise from the dead, there will be a second coming. After all, as good Catholics, they've been learning about second comings for a long time. So if it can happen to Christ, why can it not happen to the most Christ-like figure of your existence, Napoleon Bonaparte? So I think in the same tradition as Napoleon the saint that we have seen, you get the apotheosis, which becomes, again, the subject of, you know, one of these ever-popular, evergreen prints from Icignard, run off cheaply in many copies and much adored by popular craft. I don't want to finish by giving you the impression that there's something ridiculous about Bonaparte. There isn't, but there might be something slightly ridiculous about the way in which he chose to present himself. As a figure in the tradition of the Roman Empire, as a great civilizer, possibly as a slightly superhuman figure, above the capabilities of mere humans, which is why, my last slide, and I apologize for this one because it is terribly sort of self-referential, but when it came to the book, I couldn't resist putting one of the images that he liked and that you might not on the cover. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.